Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Blazers Edge podcast, presented to you by BlazersEdge.com. I'm Chris Lucia. I've been bringing you the game previews for the website this year, and I'm going to be the host of the podcast from here on out. We're going to be unrolling episodes on a bi-weekly basis, so these podcasts are going to be released on weeks between Dave and Sam's Blazers Edge video cast. So you're going to be getting fresh Blazers content in the form of either a video cast or a podcast every week from Blazers Edge. I'm personally really looking forward to making these shows as community-oriented as possible, so if you have any feedback or suggestions, please send me an email to bedgecast@gmail.com, and you can let me know who you'd like to hear in the future as a guest on the podcast, if you have any ideas for features, and going forward, I'm going to really make an effort to make it a cool show and an involved show for all the Blazers Edge readers and listeners. But if you have mailbag type questions, you can keep sending those to Dave to blazersub@gmail.com, and he'll try and get to them in either a mailbag column or a video cast with Sam. But go ahead and send anything podcast specific to me to bedgecast@gmail.com. I talked to Chris Habis from Bright Side of the Sun last week following the Blazers win in Cleveland on Wednesday, because I thought it would be really cool to get the perspective from a Phoenix Suns beat reporter and talk a little bit about the Blazers. Because even with Portland's surprising and continued success at or near the top of the Western Conference, about a third of the way into the season, the Suns really seem to have the Blazers' number, taking two out of the three matchups already. So I picked Chris's brain for about an hour, and we discussed the Phoenix-Portland matchup, the unexpected success of both teams. We covered Rob and Lopez, we got to Channing Frye, and we actually talked about quite a bit more. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Chris.
We're here with Chris Habis from Bright Side of the Sun. He also does the NBA Draft Insider, and he freelances for Dime Magazine occasionally. How's it going today, Chris?
Going well. You guys are on the heels of a victory, and we're on an off night, so it's you know, fun times. We've got two winning teams, right?
Yeah, well, I think if you think about it even further, we got two teams that are really kind of surprising in the West. If you go down the Western Conference standings here, of course, we got Portland at the top. It's always nice to see. OKC, San Antonio, Clippers, Houston. That's really no surprise. Before the season started, I probably could have had those same teams there in any given order, I would imagine, in the top four, top five. And then you have come to Phoenix at number six. Now, before the season started, I wrote the preview about the Phoenix Suns. And subsequently to that, I also wrote a game preview because we played them the first night of the season. Now, in those previews, I called Phoenix a tanking team. They were stockpiling draft picks. And then they traded away Gortat. You had Minnesota, much improved. You have Golden State that should have been in the mix. The Pelicans could have been there. You never know about the Mavs. They had a lot of talent. They still had Nowitzki. And then Phoenix is sitting there in the number six spot, right? And so what we have here is opening the season, the Blazers matched up with Phoenix. Phoenix blew them out of the water, completely unexpected. They met up again a couple weeks later. Blazers escaped with a one-point victory. And then it was Damian Lillard who shot with about 6 seconds left. And then Bledsoe missed the lay-in to go for the lead. And then there was three tip-ins that they missed too. So that was a pretty lucky break. And then they met up a couple weeks later. And tell me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Bledsoe injured for that game, or was he coming off injury?
Yeah, that was the game where Bledsoe was still out, and the Suns were, you know, back at 500 for one of the few times in the year. So they're playing that game without Eric Bledsoe, but that was the game where Goran just absolutely went off for, I think he had like 23 points and 8 assists in the first half, if I remember that correctly, finished up with 31 and 10 overall for the game, and it was just one of the better offensive, just everything clicked for the Suns in that game.
No, yeah, I mean, so what I was thinking was Bledsoe's out, And he'd been an issue for the Blazers the first two matchups. And then they came out, and then Dragic comes out, and I believe against the Blazers, he's shooting 58% from behind the 3-point line against the Blazers. On a season, he's a 38% shooter. So what is it about the Blazers that brings out the best in Dragic?
It's what's in the water in general for him lately. He went 4-for-4 the other day on the road, and then he ended up hitting, I believe, 4 out of 5 just recently here at home against the Kings. His shot, now over the past 5 games, to kind of answer your question a little bit more broader, the past 5 games in general, the combination of Bledsoe and Dragic are actually shooting 51.1% from 3 and 50% even overall from the field. So, I mean, those two guys, they're finding that groove, and they're just scoring in general and scoring very efficiently. With the Blazers, it's hard to put a finger on it, because I just did this composite and broke down all the backcourts in the NBA and kind of rated them 1 through 30 in a lot of different categories to kind of see where the Suns fall on there. And surprisingly, like, I love the Blazers backcourt. I think it's terrific. It's fantastic backcourt. But statistically, the numbers do not love them. They're not really a top 10 backcourt in anything other than scoring and 3-point percentage. They don't really distribute the ball a lot. They don't cause a lot of steals. They don't have a great assist to turnover ratio. Their defensive rating combined is not great either. They're 23rd. So I think that's kind of where you have it, is you have Damian Lillard and Wesley Matthews that are a good combo, but just defensively, they're both bigger, stronger guards, whereas Bledsoe and Dragic are more quicker, elusive guards. And I don't know how that plays into 3-point shooting, because you're just kind of standing and shooting a shot. But yeah, for some reason it clicks shooting. And then a lot of things, when you look at the Blazers and the Suns, a lot of things end up actually matching up a little bit differently when those two teams play versus when the Blazers play everybody else. So it's kind of running through the numbers, and it's kind of interesting how a few things are down against the Suns.
No, it's really bizarre, because I'm going through the list here against Phoenix, and if you look at the 3-point percentage, you got Damian Lillard and Wesley Matthews that you mentioned before, and they're at 47 and about 41%. And then you go down to Mo Williams, who's at 33, Darrell Wright, 25%, Batum, 18.8%. He makes 1 out of every 5.3 attempts against the Suns, which is rather odd, because he's about 22% higher than that on the season. So I'm not sure what it is about the Suns that affects Batum in particular, because he shoots the second most amount of threes on the team against the Suns, second only to Lillard. But for some reason, he's not making it. And I'm not sure if it's just a mental thing or if it's a particular matchup. I think he's matched up with, is it P.J. Tucker for the majority of the games?
Yeah, P.J. Tucker. And then when they bring in Gerald Green and Marcus Morris. So, I mean, the P.J. Tucker matchup and the 3-point shooting, I should say, in general, is something that the Phoenix Suns overall for the season, they were number one for a good chunk of the season. I'm not sure exactly where they're at specifically right now today. They're not number one anymore. They're number four against the 3-point shot. So it's not
defending it, right?
Yeah, defending it. It's not shocking there, because we mentioned the quickness of the guards, and PJ Tucker is a pretty good rotation defender as well. Those three do a pretty good job of hawking the 3-point line and rotating out and making people go inside, finish inside, or shoot long twos in the mid range. So that's, if we're talking about strengths and weaknesses of the team, I'd probably say the ability to get out to the 3-point line and either contest or take away a 3-point shot. The Phoenix Suns, that's probably in their top three of their wheelhouse of things that they do really, really well.
Exactly. So I think the Blazers also, they defend the 3-point line really well. Also, let's see here. 3-point percentage against them is 33.8%, and that's good for number 7 in the league. They're the best in the league at preventing attempts from being even taken in the first place. There's only 16 threes taken against them. And what the philosophy is to have the wing players and the guards play up on their man. And then they don't help very often. They don't double very often. And they leave a lot of guards tend to get by them because of that. And so you see like really ridiculous points in the paint against them. They 46.7 against them, which is good for number 28 in the league right now. So the Blazers are one of the worst teams at letting teams score against them in the paint. And so that's the philosophy behind it, is that they'll allow less efficient shots, but the 3-point shot being the most efficient shot in the league, depending on who you ask. The philosophy by Coach Stotts is to play up on that, prevent it from even being attempted in the first place. And so when it is taken, teams don't often make it against them. So does Phoenix have that same problem with penetrating guards?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that with the points in the paint, because that's something that I wrote on not that long ago, because it was kind of an alarming trend just visually watching, not hawking the numbers and looking at it and going, wow, they're really bad at this based on looking at a stat sheet. Just watching the game, they give up so many second chance points as well as points in the paint. So that's something that's really been an issue for the Suns. They're giving up 45.5 basically a game in the paint coming into right now, and they're giving up a lot of second chance points as well. So essentially they're giving up half of, or about close to half of, the points in the game in general in the paint, and also another 20 at the free throw line. So they're spotting teams the easiest shots in the game, free throws and points of the paint. They're spotting teams somewhere in between 52 and 55 points a game, and then, you know, whatever else happens, whether it's transition, three-point shots, etc. They really do struggle in the paint, even with the improvement of having Miles Plumlee down there playing a much better defensive brand of basketball than Gortat.
Yeah, speaking of Plumlee, let's go over him a bit, because I seem to remember when I was going over the previews that I was writing for the Suns, I didn't even really mention Plumlee that much, especially in the season preview before the season started, because he had played a total of, what was it, 51 minutes?
Yeah, 55 minutes, yeah.
Last season. And so I think that he surprised pretty much anybody who was paying attention to Phoenix. Let's talk about his value to the team a little bit and what he's brought to the table.
Oh, just the value's on another level. And he put an exclamation point on it the other night when he chased down at the Marcus Cousins fast break and just obliterated that shot off the backboard a la LeBron James or Tayshaun Prince. He just obliterated that shot. Just DeMarcus Cousins did what DeMarcus Cousins usually does and just was kind of lackadaisical. But his value in the – I mean, the first two games of the season really led people the wrong direction. A lot of people went all the way to one end of the pendulum thinking he was a superstar, where at the beginning of the season, nobody knew who he was. So it was the other end of the pendulum. But it's obviously somewhere in the middle there. He's, you know, 9-10 points a night, about 8-9 rebounds a night, a guy that'll get you a block or two. And I think his value is the fact that he can really alter games with those blocks. And him and Eric Bledsoe, you can probably talk about it for Portland more, of the guys that you think have the best synergy on the team. I think Eric Bledsoe and Miles Plumlee, just from the jump, I don't know what it was, whether they just like bunked together, hung out at training camp, what it was, but those two guys came in with the best synergy of any duo on the roster, with alley-oop passes, pick and rolls. Those guys just knew exactly what each other wanted to do and where they were going to be. And that's part of his success, is that he has such a good mental relationship with Eric Bledsoe on the court.
Right. Yeah. And he's shooting 50% on the season. And that's effectively leading the Suns in field goal percentage. So he's obviously taking high percentage shots. He's getting good looks, and he's converting on the looks that he gets.
Yeah, yeah, and I think with a lot of young coaches in the league, one of the things that they do, which I think is phenomenal for just a young coach perspective, and you might be able to speak to it a little bit with Portland's coach as well, Coach Hornacek, is he looks at a guy, he identifies what they're good at, he coaches to those few strengths, and then tries to take away the things that are their weaknesses and just let them go out there and do their thing with their strengths. With Miles Plumlee, he plays above the rim. He plays really well, maybe 2 to 3 feet away from the basket. He's not a guy that's going to give you post-up moves, face-up jumpers, dribble drives around folks. He's not LaMarcus Aldridge with all the versatile skills. He's a guy that's going to finish in the paint. And, you know, Coach Hornacek is coaching to that and doesn't put him in a position to be unsuccessful, which is why you see such a great field goal percentage out of him.
Yeah, and against the Blazers in particular, he's taken 9 shots a game, and he's making 57% of them, good for 12 points and almost 12 rebounds. So there's something about the Blazers that he actually likes too. And if I recall, the second game, he didn't play very well. So that first and third game, he must have really taken down the Blazers. There must be something that he's doing against Portland in particular, because he's playing well above his averages against the Blazers.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of it came from that first game. And the first, like I mentioned before, those first two games of the season gave people just this kind of crazy high expectation for what Miles Plumlee is going to be. And in that first game, he had, I don't know what his exact averages, or not averages, but totals were for the entire season. But when the second game of the season was over, he was within like one, two, or three of his career high totals that he had in Indiana after two games, including minutes played and everything. Yeah, he had 18 and 15 with three blocks against them in the first game. And then as you progress on, like you said, he wasn't super effective in the second game. You know, he had 10 and 10. He was just kind of on the court and just kind of played. And then 8 and 10 in the third game. So you take away that first game, and he's about, you know, he's kind of Robin Lopez-esque with his, like, 8 and 8, 10 and 10, couple of blocks kind of play.
Ooh, Robin Lopez. That's a name that Blazer fans are actually pretty fond of right now, as you might imagine. I think that because he was a rookie in Phoenix 5 seasons ago, and he played his first 3 years there, right?
Yeah, yeah. He got drafted over here by I believe it was the Steve Kerr regime had drafted him and drafted him fairly high. And, you know, he came out here and I guess underwhelmed expectations because of where he was drafted and folks wanted him to be better. Funniest thing about Robin Lopez to me is not his hair or his personality or any of the stories you've heard about him. It's that he probably gets, outside of maybe like a Kobe Bryant, the loudest boos from the U.S. Airways Center crowd out here when he's announced and starting. It's crazy how much boos he gets when he comes back to Phoenix for a guy that really made he made no impact out here. He was a lottery pick that was just kind of ho-hum. He wasn't great or bad, but he just gets an insane amount of boos. I don't understand why, but the crowd just, they really get up for that. It's like a wrestling crowd.
Well, let me run through a couple of these numbers here, because if you look at, you know, he didn't play very many minutes. He played, you know, 12 his first year, 18 the second year, 14, and then his last year he played about 15 minutes a game in Phoenix. But if you look at the percentages here, he was always a pretty good offensive rebounder. This year in Portland, he's off the charts. He's 14.5% of available offensive boards compared to his next highest total was 12.6. So that's pretty good. Defensive rebounding, he's been pretty consistent. He had two of his best seasons in Phoenix. And then for total rebounds, you know, his sophomore season, he was actually pretty solid there. So what is it? Was it playing behind Gortat? Is that why he just didn't have that many minutes? Because the raw numbers aren't so good, but if you break down the percentages, he actually looked like he was going to be a pretty effective player.
Yeah, and if you look at the per 36 numbers, you know, because he was playing, as you mentioned, like between 15 and 20 minutes a night for most seasons, when you break it down to per 36, like basically starter quality minutes, he was a guy out here that would have probably put up similar to better numbers as what he's doing right now in Portland. I mean, in Portland, he's almost 10 a game in terms of points, 8.5 rebounds, 1.5 blocks. That's what he would have been probably if he started out here. And he was very effective when he was next to Amari Stoudemire as kind of like that lumbering sidekick that went out there and did all the little things that an athletic scoring four-man doesn't necessarily want to do or can do. And he just kind of counterbalanced the athleticism of Amari. And I thought he was very effective next to Amari, but, you know, things happened. He moved on. He was with the Hornets last year, started all 82 games, played, I thought, a, you know, pretty solid season, and then moved over to Portland, which I thought was a great move for him. When I saw him sign over there with Portland, I mean, I don't think anyone saw 21-4, 22-4, like you said, but no. I thought it was a nice little mix with LaMarcus, whether he started or battled the other centers that they had out there.
Yeah, I feel kind of silly because I wasn't that excited about trading for him. You know, because he never really played that much. He never really had super good raw numbers. And you know, the percentages, like sometimes in limited minutes, that can be because a guy is able to conserve his energy and he's able to come out there for short bursts and just go crazy on the boards, you know. I think that Thomas Robinson, the Blazers, might be a good example of that. I think he has some really good percentages for offensive rebounds. I don't see that playing out for 36 minutes a night at the reckless way he plays. I think he'd pick up too many fouls. I think he'd make too many mistakes. So I thought maybe that Lopez's percentages were really high because it was limited minutes, and maybe that he was just meant to play, you know, 12, 15, 20 minutes a night. And he comes over to Portland, and it looks like he's playing 31.5 minutes a night. You know, and he started every game at center. He's shooting 54%. I mean, there's really nothing that he's supposed to do that he's not doing well. You know, and in fact, he's doing a lot of things really well, especially offensive rebounds. One thing I've noticed with him, and this is just kind of the eyeball test, watching him play, I don't think I've ever seen another player draw so many fouls against opposing rebounders. It seems like he's always picking up fouls against guys who are trying to fight for rebounds with him, and it seems like he always comes away on the winning end of those battles. Is that consistent with his time in Phoenix?
He's just so huge. I mean, that's, some guys are 7'2", and you know, some guys have like an 8'5" wingspan or whatever the case may be. Some guys are longer or taller than him, but he has a nice combination of just being a big, thick, strong, fairly long guy, and that's, that plays into that a lot. I mean, I can't say definitively or not whether that was just a major skill that he had out here or something he kind of acquired over the years with being just that big lumbering body in the paint, but again, he's always at his best when he's complimenting a more skilled player, whether it's in Stanford with his brother, out here in Phoenix with Amari, and clearly out there with, in most people's opinion, one of the top two or three or maybe even the best power forward in the game right now with LaMarcus Aldridge. He's the buddy comedy kind of a guy. He's the guy that's always the buddy. He's not necessarily the star, but everything he does is the reason why that guy is a star. So, yeah, I mean, he that's what I see. When I watch him play in terms of the fouls, as you mentioned there, it's just because he's such a big, bumbling body, big, burling body. He's not afraid of contact at all. Mm-hmm. He even enjoys contact with walls and fire hydrants and things like that from his time out here in Phoenix. He's a guy that enjoys the physicality and will bang with people, and not a lot of people like to get banged on, and when that happens, they're going to end up committing a lot of silly fouls.
He mixes it up down low quite a bit. I think it was the other night, LaMarcus was going on a drive or a putback, and he had sealed off Dwight Howard. And it was really subtle. It's stuff like that that's not going to show up in the box score. He boxes guys out. Maybe he's not going to get the rebound, but he's going to completely put the guy that his the opposing defender out of commission if he's working on the glass against him. It's just impossible to work against him because he's down there banging so hard. And I think he kind of gets in guys' heads because he's so willing to go for that contact. Like you said, I think that a lot of players nowadays, they don't expect it. You know, maybe they're not against it so much as they just don't expect an old school, huge 7-footer down there putting his body on the line every night, you know, and boxing guys out and doing the little things that it takes to help a guy like LaMarcus Aldridge succeed. Because I mean, if you look at Aldridge the last several seasons, you know, how many guys would call him a top two or three power forward in the game? You know, outside of the Northwest, I'm not exactly sure about that. This season, you can clearly see what he's doing. And I think Robin Lopez is one of, if not the biggest factors involved in that. Aside from, you know, whatever offseason training Aldridge does, I think Lopez is a huge contributing factor to that.
Yeah, and I was talking to Channing Frye just the other day. He was out there, not quote-unquote mentoring LaMarcus, but he was out there during his early years, and he had told me, I'm like, what is so tough about LaMarcus Aldridge to guard him? Not saying that to slight LaMarcus, but just asking in general. And he was like, I mean, just you don't expect guys that are that skilled, that quick, you know, can shoot the ball and have those kind of perimeter four skills. You don't expect those guys to also be as big and as strong as a center that can just like put their body on you, knock you back off of your feet onto your heels, and then lay the ball up. I mean, he's got just a not a unique combination, because a few guys do have this, but he's one of the few guys that have that unique combination of being a big burly guy that can put his back on you and knock you on your heels, but can also make you step out to 15, 18, 20 feet and knock down jump shots. So yeah, I mean, the skill is always there. I've always loved LaMarcus. I'm not going to, you know, pretend like I was on the bandwagon forever as him being the best power forward in the league, but I always loved him in the mix as like a top, you know, 3 to 5 guy, and just was waiting for it to all click.
Oh yeah. It's this season. It's been insane just to watch him kind of take that next level step. You mentioned the mid-range shot. Now that's something that's kind of always been in his arsenal, but this year it seems like it's just automatic. And it seems like it really scares teams. It scares teams a lot, you know. When the Suns match up with them, what do you think about LaMarcus Aldridge and his mid-range shot? Because I know it's not necessarily unique for the powered forward position, because you've seen guys like Dirk Nowitzki do it in the past to some great success. But what is it about LaMarcus Aldridge that you guys fear the most when if you're approaching a game, say, against the Suns, what would you look at with LaMarcus Aldridge, and how would you consider him to be a threat?
Oh, number one is that the power forward position, the Suns, that's been their weakest position in terms of defending for easily the past 5 to 6 years. Even like the end of the Amari time frame was when we started to see it, but it's easily been the weakest defensive position for the team, even with Steve Nash running the point. And with LaMarcus, the biggest thing is the versatility, as I said. He can put his back on you and then turn around and hit the mid-range shot. I mean, from looking at his shot chart and the spreadsheet, I mean, he spreads his shots out pretty evenly across the floor, and he kind of stays in his wheelhouse. I mean, when he gets the shot at the top of the key, it's not money, it's not automatic, but he's shooting it over 50%. And then at almost all of the other, whether it's the, you know, the corner or the elbows, he's shooting the ball, you know, well over the league average in terms of hitting it from the mid-range. So his versatility is the number one thing that scares us. But as weird as this may sound, as this is the big LaMarcus Aldridge complimentary podcast from both ends of us here, he, for some reason, maybe not necessarily the numbers, because the numbers are still good. You know, this season he's putting up 21-6 against us, 21.3, 6.6 to be precise. But for some reason, it feels like he doesn't play his best games, whether it's from an energy standpoint or all-around game. All three games this year, he's down 2.5 points and 4.8 rebounds against the Suns. He's still scoring well. He's still rebounding pretty normally. But it feels like when he plays the Suns, he doesn't play up to that par that he plays up against the rest of the league, as we see with the numbers being declined against the Phoenix Suns. And overall, the team doesn't rebound as well against Phoenix, despite having more traditional size and a starting lineup that's all, you know, pretty big for their position and all pretty good rebounders. They're down 4 games against the Suns versus the rest of the league on the season. They're getting about 41.9 against the Suns, 45.9 against the rest of the league. So it's kind of an interesting thing where the rebounding is part of the product of LaMarcus not playing amazing against the Suns and his rebounding numbers being down against us in general. I think that that's the biggest thing. When he plays us, it's for some reason not his best game. I don't think it's anything we do uniquely. It just, it happens, you know, some teams aren't great matchups for each other.
Yeah, that's 6.7 rebounds in 3 games against the Suns this year. And I think he's having career numbers for rebounds. Yeah, 11.7 against the rest of the league. So it's like, I don't know what the Suns are doing, but LaMarcus, as you mentioned earlier, is really, you know, he's shooting relatively well. I mean, a little 21 points a game. He's getting to the line. He's hitting his free throws. It's just that when it comes to getting the rebounds, he's just not there. And his offensive rebounds, he gets fewer than 2, and he gets 5 defensive rebounds. So I'm really just not sure what it is about the front court in Phoenix that prevents him from getting down low and getting those rebounds. And maybe it's a mental thing against the Suns. I'm not sure.
Well, it's that, and I think part of the product also is that when you're running a pick and roll, normally you can take a step back on most guys. Some guys you got to, you know, hedge up and you got to defend them because they can shoot. With the Phoenix Suns, when they run pick and rolls with Channing Frye, for example, or when they're running their 3-man action, having a pick and roll with Miles Plumlee and having him crash, and then running another side pick and roll with Channing and having him step out to the 3, that's, you know, you're not going to get a lot of defensive rebounds when you're standing 27 feet away from the basket with your hand in the air, diving in the other direction, trying to stop a 3-point shot. So, I mean, that's part of it. But then again, he doesn't play bad against Dirk Nowitzki, doesn't play bad against, you know, Andrea Bargnani and Chris Bosh and these other 4/5 guys that are shooting the ball and they're standing 20 feet away from the basket at the minimum against, you know, against LaMarcus in the other games. It's just, yeah, with Channing Frye and with the pick and roll and the way we do things, he's not around the basket to get rebounds. He's scoring, but it feels like not a lot of his points are really affecting the impact of the game. But that's more of an eye test thing. That's not something you're going to see in the stat sheets or on box scores or anything. It's just when you watch it, you kind of see it and you feel it.
Right. And you mentioned another guy that Blazers Edge fans are going to be familiar with, Channing Frye. He sat out last season with a heart ailment. Yep. Is that right?
Yep.
But he came back this year, and it looks like he's playing relatively well. Tell us, give us a little update on Channing Frye for all the Portland fans here who miss his time here. I think he stays here in the offseason.
Yeah, he's got homes in Portland and a home out in Phoenix as well. And I mean, with Channing, it's, you know, it's a love-hate relationship with the Phoenix Suns when he shoots threes. The Phoenix fans out here love him to death, but it's that love-hate relationship where he can go 1-for-7 one night, but then he can go 5-for-7 the next night and, you know, swing the momentum. You know, the update in general on Channing is that, you know, he's starting to shoot the ball a lot better. He's up to 41.5 from three on the season. So when you see, you know, his shooting percentages, you're wondering, you know, how is he up from anything? Well, early in the season, he was having a hard time with his conditioning and getting up and down the court. And I think that was affecting his shot because a lot of it's through the legs, obviously. And early in the season, you know, he went through some shortcomings shooting the ball, you know, 1-for-5, 3-for-8, 0-for-0-for, and had some tough shooting nights. But he's really clicked over the past handful of games, and he's shooting the ball at a very, very high level. I mean, in fact, when you look at, you know, the last, I think it's about 10 to 11 games on the season, he's shooting the ball 48.5% from three, making almost three a night. Like, it's just, it's crazy his shooting lately, you know, getting those trailer threes like Dirk Nowitzki does, or getting those pick and pop threes, and even just catching it and just throwing it up with the guy right in his face, just because he knows they're not expecting it and they're not used to defending it, and they're all going in right now. So that's the biggest thing with Channing. He's starting to really affect the impact of the game in a positive way now. And, you know, he's got a couple more years left on his contract. The fans out here absolutely love him. You know, he's from out here, went to high school out here. Nobody dislikes Channing Frye, basically. So it's not shocking that one of the nicest cities in the world, Portland, still absolutely loved Channing Frye, even though he hasn't been there for a little while.
Yeah. And it looks like if you're looking at his three-point percentage for his career, his best season was 09-10 with the Suns. That was his first season with the Suns after signing the contract there. But 41.5%, that's his second best season from outside. So that's pretty good to hear that Channing's doing really well. I know that the Portland fans love to hear about former guys who still love to spend time in Portland. And he's definitely one of those guys that really embraced and kind of embodied, I think, for a lot of Portland fans, the Portland slash Northwest lifestyle, even coming from, you know, somewhere like the desert, which is so much different. But yeah, we like to hear about him, and it's good to see that he's doing really well.
Yeah, definitely. And he's, you know, he, like I said, he's got a few years left on his contract, and, you know, the Suns playing well, people are going to throw trade rumors out there for guys that have good contracts and would impact a winning team in a positive way. But, you know, we'd love to keep him out here, I'm sure. You know, if a deal comes around, they'll probably swing him, because that's just the aggressive mind state of this new partnership that's out here. I got a question for you. So with how good you guys are doing out there and how well you're playing, all the rumors around the Suns, who are they going to trade now that they're actually a serious team and they're winning, yada, yada. Other than maybe tweaking the bench a little bit and adding maybe an energy four-man that can go out there and defend and rebound, do you feel that there's a need or a want or a desire for a trade out there in Portland?
A trade for Portland, I am not entirely sold on the idea. Here's the thing. The Blazers are 22-4 right now. Nobody expected that. If you look at all the raw numbers, all of the acquisitions this offseason, nobody anticipated that. So there's something to this team that is allowing them to be successful. 22-4, the numbers, you know, aren't going to lie at that point. I think that's enough of a sample size to say that this is a good team. And so I think that maybe that unquantifiable thing that we all missed the mark on this offseason when we were making our predictions for the Blazers, maybe that's team chemistry. Maybe this is just the perfect roster. Maybe not the perfect, but the most balanced roster that Neil Olshey could have made this offseason. I'm not a huge fan of messing with something like chemistry, because you could bring a guy in and it could mess up the whole thing. You could subtract a guy and it could mess up the whole thing. I think that right now the Blazers have a really good thing going. And, you know, other than maybe trading one of the last 3, 4, 5, 6 guys on the bench, I wouldn't want to see anyone in the top 8 or 9 dealt, unless it was for a clear upgrade in talent, maybe a future pick in the 2014 draft. I know that, you know, that's going to be a pretty solid draft, obviously. We've heard about that. But, you know, who's trading? Who's going to trade, you know, first rounder in this draft for Darrell Wright? You know, that's not happening. So I'm not a huge fan of going for a trade right now. I think that Olshey should, you know, he should answer the phone and you know, listen to other teams and see what they got to offer. But I don't see why they would be active in trying to trade anybody. I don't see a reason to mess with what they have right now.
I'm glad you just said everything you said. So everything you just said, ditto for me, put it in a bottle, send it out to Phoenix. That's my exact answer to people that say, hey, should the Suns be looking for trades as well? It's 14-9 is not as good as 22-4, but 14-9 is probably about 10 more wins than people thought they were going to have at this point. And it's working. It's clicking. They've won 5 in a row. So I would mess little subtle tweaks, like you said. Sure, I'm okay with that. But, you know, the Blazers have all the leverage in the world when it comes to trades. And with 4 potential draft picks in the first round, the Phoenix Suns have all the leverage in any potential trade conversation as well. So little tweaks, you have all the leverage. Just kind of sit back and enjoy something that's working, maybe.
Well, here's the thing with Phoenix. It's awesome to see that they're 14-9. Unless maybe you're in that front office. Because if I'm not mistaken, I think that, you know, the majority of writers and bloggers, I think, had Phoenix probably in the top 5 or bottom 5 of the Western Conference, if not the bottom 3. And it looked, and with the Gortat trade and with the stockpiling, the draft picks, it seemed like they were really going toward making this season count. In the opposite direction, maybe trying to, I don't want to say tank, but acquire a better draft pick.
Yeah.
Is that kind of a bummer to see, maybe? Or is it just so exciting to see your team play so well?
So here's the thing with that is my counter argument to anybody that goes, man, I wish we were losing so we can get a top 5 pick in the draft is the whole point of getting a top 5 pick in the draft is to have a quote unquote homegrown type, you know, guy that you can build around, that you can have for forever, own their rights, maybe keep them around for a long time. They might have that in Eric Bledsoe. They might have made that trade to get that quote unquote number one guy in Eric Bledsoe when they traded Jared Dudley away. And then now you can use those late round picks to, you know, maybe get other players, you know, use those as sweeteners in trades or draft, you know, Archie Goodwin type level talents in the back 5 of the draft and hope that they turn out into something. So, you know, it's a little bit of a bummer because I'm a draft guy, obviously, and it would have been awesome to see the Suns competing for like an Andrew Wiggins, a Joel Embiid, Jabari Parker, so on and so on and so on. It'd be really cool to see them, you know, playing for one of those guys and have them suit up the uniform out here. But on the flip side of it, you enjoy the winning, you potentially make the playoffs, you play a series, you know, I'm not going to go crazy, or maybe a series or two, and you enjoy what you got. You bring back Bledsoe because you own all the leverage in his situation as well. And you kind of play off of that, just try and get a little bit better each offseason. And maybe this Goran and Eric Bledsoe backcourt turns into something really, really special. And it's like a top, you know, 5 to 6 backcourt in the league. And you kind of play off of that and build around it. But, yeah, it's a little upsetting. I'm not going to lie and say that, you know, it's all gravy that we're not getting a top pick. A lot of people are really upset at that. But the winning is definitely counterbalancing that.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they have 4 picks. But one of them is their own. And then the other 3, aren't they lottery protected for next season and the following season?
For the most part, yeah. The Washington pick is top 14 protected. The Minnesota pick is top 13 protected. So they can still acquire that pick if they miss the playoffs, if they land in the 14 spot. And then the Indiana pick is basically locked in, certified theirs, because that one's lottery protected. So with the way things are going, they're the 6th best team in the West, like you said. So they're going to have 2 picks in the bottom third of the draft, essentially.
So as the NBA draft insider, would you prefer a mid to later round pick in 2014? Or would you rather roll the dice in the future and have a lottery pick in maybe 2015 or 2016?
If somebody was willing, and it would take more probably than just a late round pick or a combination of 2 late round picks, but if somebody was willing to unprotect a pick at least in the top 3 or just unprotect it in general and send that over, the 2015 draft it's not as vaunted, but it's got solid, solid players that are definitely on the horizon that I think will be impact game changers for the NBA for years to come. So I would absolutely trade 2 picks in the back end of the first round, you know, the 2 picks there, and mortgage those out for a pick that is going to be unprotected and might potentially be top 5 in that 2015 draft. There's a lot of talent, and, you know, players might return. So there's also that element of it, too, where you might have some guys come back that were going to be top picks this year. We saw it with Marcus Smart, and we'll probably see it with somebody else as the time goes on.
Yeah, I'm kind of bummed out because this year is the year that we're going to be handing over the pick to, I believe it's to Charlotte.
Yep.
The top top 12 protected pick. And it just happens to come in 2014, you know, the best draft in what, a decade or a decade and a half?
Yeah, yeah, it has that potential to be LeBron, you know, 2003-like. There may not be a LeBron player, but I definitely think that there might be a Dwayne Wade or two. There might be a Carmelo Anthony or two, a Chris Bosh or two. Maybe there's not a LeBron, but I definitely think that there's some superstar-level franchise-changing players in this draft.
Yeah, and, you know, with you know, Portland being 22-4, and like you mentioned with Phoenix, let's just enjoy the ride a little bit. It sucks that we don't get a pick in this draft, but hey, 22-4, 84% winning percentage. I'll take that 26 games into the season.
And Damian Lillard. So, I mean, there's there's a whole lot of things to be happy about, like actually landing Damian Lillard and LaMarcus Aldridge developing, Matthews getting him, getting Batum, having CJ McCollum not even play a game and being 22-4. So if he doesn't play this year and you bring him in next year, it's like you had a lottery pick in 2014 because you're bringing in, you know, McCollum after not playing or not playing very much.
Basically. And you mentioned Damian Lillard, and you mentioned how well he's playing. But the thing about Lillard, it's crazy, is that his numbers, and especially recently, they haven't been through the roof. He's actually been pretty bad from behind the three-point line at times this season. Lately, that's actually been his saving grace. But for the season, he's actually down from when he started. Yeah, he's at 37.6, and I think he was above 40 for the season. And then he's 38% on normal field goals. He's taken 15 a game and making fewer than six. And so really, it's kind of crazy to see him put in, you know, 20, 23 points a night and do it on 5 of 15 shooting. What is the outsider's perspective on Damian Lillard? Because here I think it's kind of hard to see it with unbiased eyes, you know, because we're just so excited to see him play so well. But if you dissect the numbers, you know, maybe he's not doing as well as we thought. I'm not exactly sure. What does someone from Phoenix think about him, for example?
He's kind of a chucker, you know, when, like you mentioned the numbers there, it kind of feels like a guy that, you know, he goes out there and get his numbers, but he does it by shooting 8, 9, 10, 11, I mean, even 12 three-point shots a game. He did that against Phoenix, ironically, in the opener. He puts it, he kind of seems like that guy that just chucks up a lot of threes. But as you mentioned, at the end of the game, if you look at a box score and you don't really feel the impact of the game but see that they scored 25, it's like a double-edged sword because you're like, well, nothing he did impacted the game, but he still got his numbers. So that's kind of a good thing because he did it kind of sneaky and quiet, but right. It's also, you know, you want to be able to have a guy put their fingerprints on a game. You want to have that Miles Plumlee block. You want to have that Eric Bledsoe alley-oop pass or that Goran Dragic momentum three. You want to have those kind of things that impact the game. But like I said, it can be a good thing when you're kind of sneaky quiet and you're getting 8, 9, 10 free throw makes a night or you know, getting those on those nights where you're not shooting it well. So the outsider perspective on Damian Lillard is – the Phoenix Suns got Kendall Marshall and the Portland Trailblazers got Damian Lillard. And that's the outsider perspective from Phoenix. That's pretty much what I'll tell you if you're looking at comment boards out here in Phoenix.
Yeah, it's just almost counterintuitive at times. You know, you don't think that Damian Lillard, you know, may had no effect on the game or was kind of nondescript. You look at some of these numbers sometimes and you see 6 for 16, 6 for 17. And you think, that guy missed a lot of shots. You know, you're watching the game and you see the flow of the game and you see what happens. But if you check the box score, it's like, what is this guy doing where he so blatantly passes the eyeball test and he completely changes the flow of the game? But in the stats, it's just not coming through right now. Except for, yeah, in total points, he's scoring 19 points a game, which is pretty good from the point guard position. I think maybe hitting 94% from the free throw line and getting to the line as much as he has been is really, really what's been saving him for the whole team. And what's been really saving us from really criticizing these numbers a lot more, because he's getting to the line, he's changing the flow of the game, he's disrupting other teams' defensive sets by getting into the lane and drawing fouls on their big guys. And hitting 95% of his, you know, free throws, that's always going to help your team win. So it's kind of a double-edged sword with Lillard. So far this year, we haven't really experienced the other end of it. because he's been producing so well when he needs to. He hit the game winner against Detroit. He hit the game winner against Cleveland earlier tonight. And he hit the game winner against the Suns. So I guess you could say when it matters, fans in Portland, some fans call it Lillard time. He's there and he delivers. And it seems to be that he's got that moxie and, you know, that swagger, if you will. He's ice cold at the end of the games. And, you know, I think that's really what makes him an impact player. You know, that getting to the line, drawing opposing defenders in, and then he can kick it out.
Yeah, and I mean, the kind of the crazy thing is, because I think most people's perspective on Damian Lillard is that he's one of the premier point guards in the NBA. I think that's a general consensus from an outsider perspective. But I don't think anyone thinks that way of Goran Dragic, or they're kind of starting to think of it of Eric Bledsoe because he had some shine playing out in LA for a little while. But those two guys, I mean, three guys, are all within 1 point or one assist of each other. And they basically statistically are almost the same exact person, except for the two guys in Phoenix are shooting a little bit more efficiently. Damian Lillard's got 3 game winners, though. I think that's kind of a gold star next to his name, as you mentioned, whether it's, you know, Lillard time or whatever folks want to call it. having a guy that makes plays, I mean, Eric Bledsoe has his 1 game winner this year, and those are the kind of things that people remember, and you get that kind of a reputation at the end of games when you nail a game-winning three and then you're dribbling the ball with 20 seconds to go, and the guy that's guarding you knows you hit a game-winning three. Now you can go around that guy probably a little easier. Damian Lillard has that, where folks are looking at him and they're going, hey, this guy's clutch. He hits shots or he gets to the rim at the end of the game. Now my knees are shaking a little bit when I'm guarding him because I know that he can do it and he's done it before. You guys have that guy. And then you got a stockpile of really, really good to, you know, very, very good NBA players all around him.
Yeah, it's crazy because I think a lot of times before the season started, and maybe in seasons past, the discussion was who's tradable in the Blazers starting five. And you're going to see a consensus that LaMarcus Aldridge and Damian Lillard, you know, they're going to be considered untouchable from just about anyone's perspective. And then you have the next tier, which is Batum. At the time, the Blazers didn't have a tradable center. And then, Wesley Matthews. It seemed to be the guy that everyone was willing to trade, you know, if the right trade came along. And then this season, I think you're seeing him come around, and really Coach Stotts has put him in a position where he can succeed. He does what he's good at. He hits threes. You know, Damian Lillard comes down, drives to the hoop or dumps it off to Aldridge. Wesley Matthews comes off the screen. If he's got a good look, he's got the green light to take it. And if not, what you see oftentimes is making the extra pass. And I think that's been a huge factor in how Portland's playing this year. Have you noticed that going against the Blazers, their willingness to pass? Because when I watch them play, it seems like, you know, I watch a lot of games on League Pass, and I hear some of the other the game commentators saying, wow, look at these guys willing to make the extra pass. Is that something you notice with the Blazers when you watch them play?
Yeah, they're easily one of the most unselfish teams in the NBA. I mean, I know right now in the season, they're the fourth most frequent assist per game team as a team right now. And when you look at the teams that are at the top of that category, I know it's silly to judge teams off of one thing, but San Antonio's 1, Atlanta's 2, Miami's 3, Portland's 4, Clippers, Wizards are not very good, but you kind of get the pattern there. Teams that either are overachieving or are very good share the rock. And I've said this for 2 years, that I thought that last year the Blazers had the best combination of, they were the best young starting five in the NBA, and they were almost, if not the best starting five in the NBA. I thought, it's to steal Bill Simmons' term, which clearly doesn't work for the Nets this year, but the Blazers have really good geometry, you know, as he liked to say about the Nets at the beginning of the season. I think the Blazers have amazing geometry in the fact that all the pieces kind of fit. They all work well together. They all do something very well. Like, all four of the five starters can shoot the ball pretty darn well. You know, five of the five starters pass the ball or make the extra pass. All five of them are capable of rebounding. So none of them are defensive stoppers or great or anything, but I stand by that comment, and I'll go that next step. This is the best starting five in the NBA are the Portland Trailblazers, because all five of those guys don't really have an inherent or unique flaw that you can kind of go and attack and take the Blazers out of their game. All five of those guys do their thing on offense, and like you said, Coach lets them do what they do well, and it allows them to just be successful. I mean, defensively, this team has a lot of ways to go, but offensively, this just everything lines up, everything clicks. It's just this team is very well put together in the starting five to where it all balances and everything just meshes very well together.
Yeah, I think offensively, they're not impossible to stop, obviously. I mean, you've seen some teams play pretty effectively against them, but you have that number one option in LaMarcus Aldridge, who's taken almost 20 shots a game, converting over half of them. You got Damian Lillard, you know, even if he's not converting at a high rate, he's affecting the defense and he's getting to the line. And he's got about 6 assists a game, so he's kicking the ball out. Wesley Matthews, Nicholas Batum, Darrell Wright off the bench, Mo Williams off the bench, they can all hit outside shots. And maybe the averages over the season, if you look at it, you have some give and take there. You know, they're not all shooting consistently well all the time, but it seems like, you know, at least through the first 26 games of the year, 1, 2, or 3 guys out of that group of 5 3-point shooters steps up, you know, every game. There's just a combination of guys that hits. You know, if Mo Williams is 1 for 5, Batum might be 3 for 4 or 3 for 5. You know, so everyone's stepped up, and it's kind of a well-oiled machine on offense. Defensively, though, you see teams score quite a bit on them, and I don't want to be pessimistic or negative, but I kind of wonder at what point are teams going to find out what they can focus on and how they can attack this Blazer defense, because against the Pistons the other night, Josh Smith was posting up, going to the paint. The Blazers had a pretty difficult time stopping that. And I would consider Nick Batum a really long, pretty aggressive defender. And he got taken in the post quite a bit by Josh Smith from what I saw.
Yeah, so question for you is, we talked a little bit about, on my perspective, what I think the Suns do well, and the little bit on what LaMarcus Aldridge doesn't necessarily do well against the Phoenix Suns. When you watch the games, they've lost 2 out of 3 from Portland's perspective. The one game they did win was on a parting of the seas wide open layup by Damian Lillard, which I think still haunts Coach Hornacek's nightmares to this day. When you watch these two teams play, why do the Suns currently own half of the Portland Trailblazers' losses right now? Why do they own half of them?
It's hard to say, but I think the Channing Frye thing is not the biggest part, but I think that's something interesting that we should touch on, the way that he can come off that screen and pull Aldridge out to where he's not in the middle. When Aldridge is playing down low, you know, that's when he's playing some of his best basketball, able to get rebounds and affect shots on the defensive end. He's not an elite defender, but he's a good defender. But when he's drug out by a guy like Channing Frye, you know, that's going to make life difficult. And then I think that really what does it is going to be the backcourt. It's Dragic and it's Bledsoe. Those guys can both get to the rim, they can both finish at the rim, and they can both pass out of crowded situations in the key for open shots. And that's really tough for the Blazers, because, you know, we talked about their defensive philosophy where they play up on the wings a little bit more, but that allows a lot of penetration from guards. And when that happens, obviously you see other defenders have to sag off or come and help. And really, the Blazers just don't defend particularly well in the paint, and teams are able to finish against them. And that's something that Dragic and Bledsoe do really well. And then on the season, you have P.J. Tucker. Let's see here. I'm going to go through the three-point field goal percentage here, because there's a lot of weapons for Phoenix. You got P.J. Tucker at 46%, Channing Frye below him, Marcus Morris, they're both at 41%. Dragic somehow is hitting 38% this year. Isn't he about a 33 or 34% career three-point shooter?
Yeah, he's never been known as a sniper or a legit three-point shooter, but I will say that when he gets open looks and he's playing off the ball, he's actually a much better shooter than what maybe the percentages show. Like when he's the on-the-ball, you know, creator, he's not the best three-point shooter, but definitely when he's off the ball and playing in that, as I, you know, wrote about today, the Manu Ginobili type role of the two guard that can really do a lot of one stuff, I think he's a much better shooter.
Yeah, and so when he's hitting his three-pointer, you know, that's going to be dangerous against the Blazers, especially you know, when they're collapsing on Bledsoe or helping out on that. And then you got Gerald Green, who at the time, I think when he was playing the Blazers, he was hitting like 46% or so. He's cooled down a little bit from three, but he was hitting almost half of his three-pointers. Bledsoe's, you know, he's creeping up to about 35% on threes. And he's about, what is he, a 29, 30% career shooter? So he's having an improved year shooting from beyond the arc. And then you got Markieff Morris, who's not super good at three-pointers, but if I'm not mistaken, he can drag out defenders pretty well, to the mid-range at least.
Yeah, yeah. And the good thing about the Bledsoe, Markieff that you mentioned, those guys in specific, is that Coach Hornacek has distributed their shots to other players, having, ironically, Marcus Morris shoot more of Markeith's threes, and then maybe giving some of like the traditional, you know, pull-up threes by a point guard from Eric Bledsoe, giving those over maybe to like a Gerald Green or a Channing Frye. He's making these guys play in their lanes, and when Eric Bledsoe takes a three, it means something. And when Markieff Morris takes a three, it means something. It's not just, you know, as we called Damian Lillard a chucker a little earlier. These guys aren't doing that. These guys are shooting very selective, very, you know, time-appropriate three-point shots, which is really helping their percentages. When you play 10 minutes a game, you can be real effective, like we said earlier. Jump up to 36 minutes a game and your efficiency might go down. That's kind of almost like the philosophy the Suns are taking with a lot of these guys with their three-point shooting.
Yeah, you got the Morris brothers. They're both playing below 25 minutes a night. You got Channing Frye, he's playing below 30. PJ Tucker's at 31. The only guys who play more than 34 minutes a night are Dragic and Bledsoe. So it looks like it's quite the team effort down there in Phoenix right now.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it's when you can go essentially eight deep, I don't want to say that they go nine deep because really Archie and Ishmael are more like, you know, wild cards or back to back, throw those guys out there for fresh legs and stuff of that nature. But when you can go eight deep like the Suns do, and I think Portland to an extent goes basically eight or nine deep as well. And when CJ McCollum comes back, if he's effective as a rookie, he'll really add to that depth. That's another, you know, part of the winning process. When you have a quality of depth, they may not have a superstar, and people might even say that Portland doesn't have a quote unquote superstar, but they have depth and they have quality of depth. I think Portland's quality of depth is clearly better and more talented, but Phoenix has, you know, a nice little quality of depth that allows them to be 14-9.
Well, the depth for the Blazers, I think, might be a bit misleading if you were following the team last season, because really, Mo Williams is playing 25 minutes a night off the bench. Behind him, you have Joel Freeland, who was on the team last season, playing 15 minutes. Darrell Wright, Thomas Robinson, they both play 13 minutes or less. And then you have a huge jump off to Earl Watson, Myers Leonard, and then, you know, the rest of the bench. So those guys hardly ever play. Coach Stotts is really, really relying pretty heavily, not as much as last season, but he's relying quite a bit on his starters. You got LaMarcus Aldridge at almost 37 minutes a game. Batum and Lillard are both at 35. Lopez, 31.5. So that's being balanced pretty well, and with the effective play of Joel Freeland, you know, that's helping out quite a bit. But really, the depth, it helps, and it helps to be able to plug in guys. I like seeing Williams and Wright come in off the bench and be able to hit threes and play within the offense. And then you see Thomas Robinson come in about 11 minutes a game, just crash the board super hard. But you see a lot of boneheaded plays from him sometimes too, man. It's just, I don't know if the depth is everything that it's hyped up to be. I think that the starters have just been playing incredibly well. And, you know, Stotts is able to plug in guys situationally off the bench to the point where they don't affect the game negatively too much, let's say. Because he really doesn't go past Thomas Robinson in the rotation. You know, past that, it's Earl Watson, and he's only played five games this season. So he only goes about eight and a half deep.
Yeah, and you know what? I think you just finally, it took us about an hour to do so, but I think we finally found the reason why Phoenix is so effective against Portland. It's because when those Kansas boys get on the court against each other, I don't know why, they go into this weird, strange one-on-one game. And I've watched it live in two out of the three games, and then watched it on TV with the other one when they were in Portland. for some reason, when they're on the court at the same time, those guys feel like it's a game of one-on-one after practice back in Lawrence, Kansas, and they do some weird stuff on the court, like you said, with Thomas Wright. It's not a one-way street. Markieff and Marcus do the same thing when they see Thomas Robinson on the court, and it really detracts from the team, and it really detracts from the overall efficiency of the game. So there you go. I think that's it. That's why, because Thomas Robinson makes more boneheaded plays than the Morris twins do when they play head-to-head.
Dude, T-Rob had this monster put-back dunk against the Suns in the win that Portland had.
Yeah.
And if you recall, it was what changed the tide of the game, actually, was Robinson getting up there and just slamming it. And, you know, the Suns weren't able to recover after that, and Portland took the game away. So I guess some of that aggression, maybe against the Morris brothers or whatever the Kansas connection causes to happen, it actually worked in the Blazers' favor that game. So that's kind of nice to hear.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a fun matchup. And, you know, what's great is I kind of said, you know, the Suns will play one playoff series, and, you know, I don't want to go crazy and say they'll play two. But, you know, with the way that things match up out West, I think that there's a really nice hard at the very top. There's a nice little hard foundation, but there's a real soft middle in there. Like, it's not like all these teams that are above 500 are so great because the Eastern teams are under 500. But, I mean, there's a really soft middle there. I mean, Golden State is good, but definitely not a contender. You know, Houston and the Clippers, you know, good, but probably not necessarily contenders. We'll see what happens in a 7-game series. I think Phoenix, not to sound like a homer, but Phoenix is probably the safest, most probably consistent, sound type little team that I would probably trust them more to win a 7-game series than I would maybe a Golden State or a Dallas or the Lakers or the Pelicans or these other teams that are kind of middling around between 6 and 10 out there in the West. I think the top is solid with those top three teams that we talked about, Portland, OKC, and San Antonio. And then after that, there's a huge cliff you fall off of, like the minutes per game after Thomas Robinson. It's like there's a huge cliff you fall off of there in the Western Conference. Real soft middle, in my opinion.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And the way things are shaken out, I'm not entirely convinced that Portland can stay at number one the whole season. I'm going to enjoy it while it lasts, and I'll take an 84% winning percentage, absolutely. But I'm not sure if they can sustain it, especially with just how well Aldridge is playing and how many minutes him and Lillard and Batum are getting. I think that might average out to the mean a little bit closer toward the end of the season, and you'll see them finish maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 range, possibly. It's really hard to say, but they're definitely in the mix with Oklahoma City and San Antonio at the top. And then at the bottom, you got the Suns there in 6. And I see that as potentially one of the worst first-round matchups for the Blazers, as we've talked about this whole podcast. Phoenix is just not a good matchup for the Blazers. So I hope that you know, it's not Portland 1 seed and then Phoenix 8 seed.
Yeah.
Because that would be a really rough first round. I think that the Blazers could pull it off, with all due respect. I don't think I would want to see them go through a 7-game battle potentially against the Suns in the first round.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? The Suns struggle against the Kings. And not saying that, like, that's a parallel, because Portland and Phoenix are both really, really good and very good versus, you know, the Suns being very good and the Kings being abysmal. But, you know, everyone struggles against who they struggle against. The Suns struggle against the Kings. Portland happens to struggle against the Suns. The good thing for them, though, is that they are, what, like a collective 21-2 against the rest of the league. So they're doing something right. It's just that matchup against the Suns that doesn't click well. And, you know, the Suns match up pretty well, I think, against San Antonio in that first game that they played. They played pretty well. And they'll be playing them here on Wednesday. And they, you know, play against Portland pretty well. But other teams just shellack them. Like, Oklahoma City really gets into them. And other teams really get into them depending on the night and the time. But, yeah, Portland, you know, I think that they'll be in the mix of a top 3 seed. I don't think they'll dip much lower than that, just because I think the Clippers and the Rockets are more pretenders than contenders. And I think the Suns, you know, unless something goes wrong or they fall off a cliff, I think that they're fairly safe in that probably like 5-7 mode. I don't think they go higher than 5. I don't think that they fall much lower than around that 7 marker. But I'm actually rooting for a Portland-Phoenix series, not because I think that they'll knock them off, but because I think it'll just be fun basketball, and then me and you can revisit this conversation in the playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely.
that's definitely not a matchup that Portland fans are looking forward to.
I'd imagine.
As you can imagine with the record. But as you mentioned, I think they meet for the final time in April.
And I might actually be out in Portland when that game goes down, because it's a tournament that I go out to in April, usually in like mid to late. I think they play in early April, unfortunately. So, yeah, I'll probably catch like one or two Blazers games live when I'm out there in Portland, and one of them might be that Suns game. We'll see.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. The Moda Center is rocking this year. I've been there for several games. It's definitely – it kind of toward the beginning of the season, it wasn't too crazy, but lately, oh, yeah. The crowd gets up. The crowd's been into it. 22-4. It's been great for everyone. So I'm looking forward to playing Phoenix in April. I'm looking forward to a potential – I'm not exactly looking forward to it, but I'd look forward to breaking down a potential Phoenix matchup in the future in the playoffs. And it's been great talking to you. I really appreciate you coming on the Blazers Edge podcast and talking to me.
For sure, man. It was great stuff. And, you know, the Chris and Chris connection here. We had some fun talking about Portland and Phoenix.
Thank you for listening to the first episode of the Blazers Edge podcast. Make sure and check out Chris Habas's work over at brightsideofthesun.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris_Habas. That's KRIS_HABBAS. I'll be back with another episode shortly after the new year, so I'd like to wish everyone a happy and safe holiday season. For BlazersEdge.com, I'm Chris Lucia.